Hey guys. What the hell happened to the levels on this board? Hey guys. I'm Scott. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. How's that sound? Okay. Yeah, music's playing. That means the show's started, and I better say stuff. Come here, microphone. I need to talk at you here. All right. Today on the show, Abby Hall will be here. Never spoken with her before, but she's co-authored a study, not just an article, but a study with Professor Christopher Coyne here called Perfecting Tyranny. Oh, I think you'll like the interview. I think you'll like the study. Perfecting Tyranny, Foreign Intervention as Experimentation in State Control. Ooh, doesn't that just sound right up this show's alley? War is the health of the state, after all. And that's a bad thing, see? Okay, good. And then Darge Mail is going to be here. I screwed up. I don't know why I thought Thursday. I was going from memory, and my memory, well, it was lying to me. He wasn't even supposed to be on the show yesterday. He was supposed to be on today, and he's going to be on today. Darge Mail, unembedded Iraq war reporter, is going to tell us what for on the case of Obama's war. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to rhyme. Obama's Iraq War 3 now. The great Darge Mail. And then the other Scott Horton is going to come on, and I'm going to ask him about the law. And I know there's no such thing as the law. Don't be stupid. You know, it's just propaganda for letting these gangsters pretend that they're government and all of that. But so, well, it's important to talk about the law so that we can see the discrepancy there. For the slightest infraction, they'll put you behind bars for a decade if they feel like it, more. But government employees, they can do anything. Yes, the cops can gun down unarmed black people, well, especially black people, but others too, in the streets. And presidents can torture, and they can spy, and they can start aggressive wars. The greatest war crime of all, they can do whatever they want because there's no such thing as the law. All the Constitution says, really John Yoo is right, I think. The Constitution says there can be a government and it can do what it wants, and what are you going to do about it? Yeah, right, that's what I thought. That's the full text of the Constitution right there. There can be a government and they can do whatever they want, and what are you going to do about it? We the people, yeah. Anyway, so other Scott Horton... he's not an anarchist like me. He's pretty libertarian, but he's not so cynical. And he's going to be on, and, well, it'll be interesting to see what he says about the Constitution and the war powers. And, you know, he's the author of a brand new book that I have sitting on my desktop and haven't gotten to yet. I need to, like, take 2 months off and just... lock myself in an attic like the Never-Ending Story and get these freaking books read. I have so many books to read. What am I going to do? Other Scott Horton's book is one of them. And it's about the lawless empire, that kind of stuff, you know. It's about the drone wars and the assassination wars and the secrecy behind which the empire gets away with its crimes, you know, that kind of stuff. So, yeah, the other Scott Horton, heroic anti-torture international human rights lawyer, will be on the show today. Abby Hall, Darge Mail, other Scott. That's pretty good, especially considering two out of the three of them just came together after the top of the hour news was already playing. I'm way behind on getting the show together today, I admit it. All right, so, hey, you can follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show, and retweet me. You can also join up the chat room. A few people in there today. Hey, guys. I think we can do better, especially on a Friday. Today's Friday, right? Yeah. So, yeah, you know, stack them on up in there, guys. ScottHorton.org/chat. And then you guys can talk about El Camino restoration. You can talk about the wars. Whatever you want. It'll be great. scotthorton.org/chat. And then, like you could infer there, scotthorton.org, that's my website. I keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,500 of them now, going back to 2003. And you can find my whole show archives there as well, articles I've written and documentaries that other people made that I would like you to see, and some fair use articles that are very important to me but hard to find around the web. I just posted a new one last night. It's Bush's Meeting with a Murderer by Robert Dreyfus, and he wrote it for TomPaine.com, which I guess is now just an adjunct of some Democratic-type think tank, and they took down all their great articles from the Bush era. Unbelievable. Well, somebody had a saved copy somewhere online, but I went ahead and saved it myself and put it there. I hope Bob doesn't mind. In fact, the first interview that I did for Anti-War Radio in December of 2006 was Robert Dreyfus, and it was about his article, Bush's Meeting with a Murderer, and about how Muqtada al-Sadr wanted to create a coalition government of all Arab Iraqi nationalists against Iran and America, and how Bush was siding with Abdulaziz al-Hakim, the leader of the Supreme Islamic Council, a.k.a. the, you know, pinky finger of the Ayatollah Khamenei, supreme leader of Iran. And they had a far different plan than Sadr's government of national salvation coalition of Sunni and Shia Arabs. Their idea was, no, we'll just get George Bush, the idiot, to have the army and the Marine Corps continue helping the Shiite militias kick all the Sunnis out of Baghdad, and then we'll take the South, and we'll have George W. Bush, Shiastan, Ayatollah land in the South, and the Sunnis can rot in hell. The majority Sunni areas of the country. That was their plan all along. They called it strong federalism. And with the title, Bush's Meeting with a Murderer, of course, what Robert Dreyfus is referring to there is that the Supreme Islamic Council, their army was called the Badr Brigade. And their Badr Brigade ended up being called the Iraqi Army. And then eventually, later on, with the help of Sadr's forces, too, after it was already, a couple of years later, I guess, or a year later, they were the ones who were kicking all the Sunnis out of Baghdad. Sadr ended up being driven by the Americans into Iran. They accused him of being the Iranian agent when he was the one trying to kick Iran and America out. And so they kept trying to kill him and or arrest him. And, well, they announced different conflicting policies there. So finally fled to Iran and became closer to them and compromised with them and pitched in, basically. Put his army to work with the Badr Brigade, kicking all the Sunnis out of Baghdad. And then Abdulaziz al-Hakim died, so he didn't even get to have all this power and influence because he died in, I think, 08 or something like that. And his son is in charge of the Supreme Islamic Council now, I guess nominally, although I don't know. Can't ever get a hold of Bob Dreyfus anymore, I don't know. He's the guy who understood that stuff best that I knew. But, it's a very important history there, you know. I'll never forget going to Libertarian Party Convention in Atlanta in 2004 and Judge Jim Gray, who is one of the leaders of the Libertarian Party, saying, no, we can't leave now. The violence will be worse. And I'm saying, not only are you wrong about that, it's America that's causing the violence and making everything worse, but right now is the greatest opportunity for the Libertarian Party to be the most hardcore, well-informed, and ass-kicking anti-war force in America. And you, sir, are destroying it by coming out Republican light and giving, you know, Bush time to fix the mess he made. And this is the mess that they were making. Jim Gray was helping give Bush cover to help the Iranians and their Shiite sock puppets kick all the Sunnis out of Baghdad, leading to the current crisis, where they have no incentive to cooperate with the Sunnis at all. Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle, containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and
independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show. Listen, so there's this really nice lady what lives on the bottom of the planet down there in Australia. And her name is Joanne, and she has a website. It's called globalhighfive.com, globalhighfive.com. And from time to time, she does transcripts of some of the interviews of this show. She's done quite a few. And now she's done two, and I'm trying to remember how many times in total I ever interviewed Barrett Brown. It might have just been the twice. But anyway, so here she is going back, and she's made, this is now the second transcript she's done of an interview that I did with Barrett Brown. I think the first one was from 2010, and this one is from 2011. She says, post-Manning, pre-Snowden, for those of you playing at home. And I admit that I could barely understand a thing the guy was saying during the whole damn interview, so I don't know how good of a job I did. It was just his phone connection. Maybe he mumbles too, but also his telephone connection is absolutely horrible. I noticed that a lot of times people, I think he was in Brooklyn, and I've had that problem with people in Brooklyn where they're just like, man, the phone service here is just the worst. But anyway, so she was able to somehow, she calls it from your underwater archives because it sounds like he's underwater. She somehow, I guess, just turned the volume up to 11 and figured out what the hell he was talking about and transcribed it here. And he's talking about how Anonymous and WikiLeaks helped with the revolution in Tunisia and in Egypt in the Arab Spring and all that. And it's really cool. And as you may know, I do hope that you are very aware. Barrett Brown is in prison right now, or I guess he's in, yeah, he's in federal, like, holding jail, right? Awaiting, I think he's done a plea bargain, so now he's awaiting sentencing. But really, the only reason that they went after him was because of his great journalism. So, and then he did a real stupid thing. And if you watch the YouTube of it, you'll just cringe because he's threatening an FBI agent. And just by definition, an FBI agent is not a person. They are an agent. I mean, that has a real definition. That means, like, they are a part of the government. They may act in its name. They are the state. You can't threaten somebody in that position at all. And now if you watch the video, it's clear that all he's saying is, like, I'm going to kick your ass in a documents fight, right? Like him, he's going to have his anonymous friends Google the crap out of this FBI agent and figure out everything about him and then post it online, you know? Right? Like what school he went to and his credit rating and whatever. But the way he phrases, like, I'm going to get you and your family and all this stuff. Oh, no. And so if you know what he's talking about, you know he's just talking about doxing them, which is not an actual assault. But in plain language, transcript form, like my cousin Vinny, I killed him. I killed him. And then you read it back. I killed him. I killed him. You know what I mean? You read it back my cousin Vinny style. Oh, no. He just threatened this cop. So anyway, he got in a lot of trouble for that. But really, they, you know, he was mad because they were persecuting him. Because he was doing good journalism about the, well, let's call it what it is, fascist, public, private, national security state, homeland security state, and how they plot and scheme to destroy people for being good citizens and doing good citizen things like journalism and stuff like that. And so that's why they went after him, and that's why he's in trouble, and I guess, you know, they're no longer trying to put him in prison for 100 years. They were trying to put him in prison for 100 years. And they've dropped one of the charges, one of the major charges against him was they were trying to accuse him, and I don't know specifically under the law what they called it, but they were trying to accuse him of a crime for copying and pasting a link from one chat room to another. where someone else had hacked the archives of Stratfor and posted the information online. He linked to it and said, hey guys, let's go through this data and see what it is. Well, that data included credit card information. So then they tried to, you know, basically make it like he was driving the getaway car or whatever. He's an accessory, or he in some way gets to be caught up in the hacking of this data. When no, really, he just copied and pasted a link to it. It was already online. You didn't need a password or nothing. He just pointed other people toward it. And so, no, he's completely innocent of that. It was a giant trumped-up charge, and he beat that charge. They dropped that in favor of a guilty plea, I believe. I'm not 1,000,000% on that, but I'm pretty damn sure that's how it's working. So he's still in jail, waiting final sentencing, and I don't know, maybe you're magic, or you're a billionaire, or you golf and do cocaine with a judge in your town or something. If there's anything you could do to, like, apply pressure, file an amicus curiae brief or whatever. And no, I'm not recommending anyone commit a crime with a judge, really. I'm just basically taking a pot shot at a judge. I just realized that maybe they could charge me with a crime right there. Is it a crime to recommend someone bribe or suggest to their friend, the federal judge, that they already abuse illegal drugs with? I assume that they, you know, maybe you could compromise them, take a picture of them doing some blow. Hope I didn't just commit some kind of infraction. Anyway, all I'm saying is maybe file an amicus brief and say, we like Bear Brown and would like for him to be free, and we think that he didn't really mean no harm. You know, something. See what you can do. It sucks to think the guy's, you know, sitting in prison and is going to be staying. And by the way, he writes great essays for, what is it called? D Magazine in Fort Worth. That's where he's from, is from Fort Worth. DMagazine.com. It's called Bear Brown's Review of Arts and Letters and Jail. At DMagazine.com. Oh, I guess it's Dallas, Fort Worth kind of thing. DFW. Anyway, all right, so there you go. That's what I got to say about Bear Brown. You can go read my transcript of my two different transcripts of my interviews of him. This one's from March of 2011 at globalhighfive.com. And thank you again to Joanne for all your great volunteer work transcribing these things. There was a time where she thought, yeah, I'll just transcribe all of it. And I thought, yeah, I don't know. 3-4 interviews a day, 5 days a week. That's going to get out of hand really quick, I think you'll find. One day I'll have the dragon figured out, and maybe it'll work well enough that we'll actually get away with doing automated transcripts that are close enough in the future. Oh, yeah, also, somewhere at liberty.me, I don't know if it's posted yet, but Angela Keaton interviewed me, and it will be posted. And also, Tom Woods interviewed me yesterday, and I don't know if that's playing on his show today, or already did, or maybe Monday. Is there some more housekeeping type stuff for you? All right, back in a second with Abby Hall. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism and the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Livin' La Vida Baroka by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest today is Abigail Hall. She is a research fellow at the Independent Institute. That's independent.org. Of course, that's David Thoreau, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, Robert Stinnett, the great Independent Institute there, independent.org. Abigail Hall, she is a research fellow there, a PhD candidate, and the JIN fellow in economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, which I think I pronounced wrong. Welcome to the show, Abby. How are you doing?
Fine. Thank you for having me.
Well, really appreciate you joining us. And how do you say the name of that center again?
It's the Mercatus Center.
Mercatus Center. Okay, well, I should have. I've heard of it before, but I never did remember how to say it. All right. Well, anyway, so yeah, you got this great study here at independent.org. It's the Independent Review, edited by Robert Higgs, of course. And it's co-authored with our friend Christopher Coyne, Professor Christopher Coyne. And it's called Perfecting Tyranny, Foreign Intervention as Experimentation in State Control. I think we all, everyone in the audience, right? We all think of James Madison. The instruments of foreign war become the instruments of tyranny at home. So this is a full-scale study here. The PDF file is, I had it here. It's 26 pages long. So you guys really went in depth. And I think you say in your introduction here, you really focused at the beginning, or you say in the introduction, you really focused on two specific examples, and then went at those in depth, and that would be domestic spying as well as the militarized SWAT teams at the local police level. So I guess you just take it from there and pick up one then the other.
Sure. So we start off the paper actually with a quote from Mark Twain, where he's talking about this hypothetical Great Republic. And the point that he makes about this republic is that they had been going out, engaging in all different types of foreign interventions, and that eventually what winds up happening in this great republic is that they wind up suffering these same kinds of impositions that they tried to place upon other people. So the phrase that he uses is that they've been trampling upon the helpless abroad, and they had been conditioned to endure with apathy the like at home. So what we're looking at is, what if this great republic that Twain is talking about is actually not hypothetical, but what if this is really true? What if the foreign interventions which the U.S. and other countries are engaging in don't just have the international consequences that people typically think about, but also have real far-reaching domestic consequences? So what we try to do is to examine what happens when the U.S., and again, this is generally applicable, but what happens when the U.S. government engages in foreign intervention? How do those interventions wind up coming back and demonstrating their effects domestically? So what we look at are what we refer to as coercive foreign interventions, where the government is trying to shape the political, legal, social, or economic outcomes in another country and actively invest resources to deter resistance from these foreign populations. So what we look to do is we come up with what we refer to as the boomerang effect, which illustrates how foreign intervention allows government to expand their social control techniques abroad and then implement those domestically. So if we think about what happens when the U.S. goes abroad, they're not as restricted as they are domestically. So there's some fairly strong limitations on what the government can do to its own citizens in the U.S. But when you take the U.S. government out of its domestic borders, a lot of those constraints are either relaxed or altogether absent. So we argue that this provides sort of a testing ground in which individuals in the government can engage in different kinds of social control experimentation, and then those are brought back into the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and I mean, the SWAT team is the perfect example, because there you simply have, you know, there's a direct line of descent from the creation of modern special forces after the disaster in the Iranian desert in the Carter administration to the FBI and the federal police SWAT teams, and then all the training of the local police. It's all comes from the Special Operations Command tactics. The kind of things that they train to do to foreigners is exactly the same equipment, same training, and same mentality down to our local sheriff's department.
Right. So in the paper, we identify four different mechanisms through which we can see this importation of social control techniques from abroad. So we talk about changes in, first of all, the overall structure and centralization of government. So one of the benefits of a federalist system is that you have different groups which are providing this sort of check and balance on the other groups. But what happens when the U.S. engages in a foreign intervention is that some of the groups which were providing a check on the centralized government now wind up becoming intertwined within that intervention. They're drawn into the programs and into the activities of the centralized government, and so you wind up eliminating some of those checks. We also look at issues of physical capital. This would be things like military technology, so drones or surveillance techniques is one of the examples that we talk about in the paper. Changes in human capital, or basically the things that people are good at. So if you're engaging in a foreign intervention, you're going to hone particular skills that are going to make you better at that particular job. Or from the very beginning, you're going to wind up drawing people into the intervention with that skill set. And then these kinds of things are brought back home, in particular through what we refer to as changes in administrative dynamics. So these people that have gone abroad, developed new technology, and developed these new personal skills wind up coming back, and they reallocate their talents, if you will, to public service and private service. And this really winds up changing the dynamic of a lot of different domestic companies.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that just makes a lot of sense. People come back, and I mean, after all, look at the police. I don't know what the percentages are, but it's probably majorities in a majority of jurisdictions in America of sheriffs and city police who are military veterans, and not, you know, during some 1980s, more or less peacetime, or only a proxy war era or something like that, but battle-hardened veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan.
So there's definitely a lot of crossover in terms of former military veterans who now engage in policing activities. I'm not sure of the current domestic numbers. The military actually doesn't report the civilian occupations of its members. But one of the statistics that was surprising to me in engaging in this research was that the first SWAT team, which can be traced back to the mid-1960s out in California, every member of that SWAT team had former military training.
Right. Yeah, well, and I mean, that's where they all get their training. It's the military bases, the SWAT teams, right?
Right. So we look in the paper about the early SWAT teams in particular getting training from the Marines and from other branches of the military.
Right.
And you can actually trace the origins of SWAT teams to military tactics. So the entire organization of a SWAT team is based on what was referred to as elite force recon units in Vietnam.
Right.
So if we look at the origin.
Oops. Sorry, that's the bumper music. We got to take this break. Yeah, there's a funny story there about the Marines in 2007 going back to the LAPD and saying, can you teach us the counterinsurgency tactics that we taught you back in the early 80s? Because we forgot them and now we need them for Iraq. So it goes back and forth.
I haven't heard that.
All right, we got to take this break. We'll be right back out with Abigail Hall. She's at independent.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Coming up this October 18th at Columbia University in New York, the Future Freedom Foundation is hosting a conference titled Stop the Wars on Drugs and Terrorism, featuring Glenn Greenwald, Radley Balco, Jeremy Scahill, Eugene Jarecki, Jonathan Turley, and others. The event is free and open to the public, but registration is required. Just head over to fff.org to sign up. That's the Stop the Wars on Drugs and Terrorism Conference, Saturday, October 18th, 2014 at Columbia University, sponsored by the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on the Liberty Radio Network, noon to three weekdays. I'm talking with Abigail Hall. She's co-authored this study for the Independent Review with Christopher Coyne. And, oops, now I got to rewind back up to the beginning for the correct title of the thing. Perfecting Tyranny, Foreign Intervention as Experimentation in State Control. And, you know, I was kind of spacing out during the break there. Abigail, and I was thinking about what we've learned from the Snowden documents about parallel construction. And again, I confess and I admit and I'm guilty that I have not had a chance to read this whole thing. I have scanned through quite a bit of it, so I don't know if you guys get to this exactly in here or not, but it's revealed that the NSA, through their Special Operations Division or some other name for it, likes to launder intelligence on Americans through or to the DEA or other federal and state and local police agencies, I guess, even. And then they tell them, hey, lie about how you figured this out. Don't let them know that it's this quite illegal, warrantless, you know, kind of dragnet fishing expedition type surveillance that's led to this information. Pretend that you pulled them over for having a taillight out and then make your case from there. And it seems like, wow, just imagine if it was a few years from now, and that's not even, I mean, hell, it's hardly scandalous now, but what if that just becomes official policy? Like, all right, whatever. Nobody really cared, not enough to roll it back, and so say there's another terrorist attack or two, and from now on, the NSA can go ahead and legally turn over their entire hall to all American police agencies the same way they turn it all over to the Israelis every day. And then all of our local and state police agencies have access to everything the NSA has on all of us and can pick and choose any level of enforcement they wish against any of us all day long. I mean, we could move from authoritarian to totalitarianism here in America in pretty much a day and a half, it seems like. If that was to simply become, in fact, one more thing about that, Gareth Porter's great award-winning work about this is how McChrystal and Petraeus kill people with airstrikes and target them for midnight SWAT raids by the Delta Force in Iraq and Afghanistan is they use all this metadata, whose cell phone is connected to whose cell phone, and that's who they decide to kill. So you could see, obviously, there are more legal restrictions here at home in the law for now, but you can see how we're moving more and more that way.
Most definitely. We don't talk specifically about the Snowden documents or about we mention the current incarnation of the NSA, but we're really focused on how it is that these types of relationships were built in the first place. And one of the things that we do focus on is exactly what you're talking about, is this information sharing that's going on between not just areas of the federal government, but between the federal government and state and local law enforcement. So we see things like the creation of joint terrorism task forces, which have exploded, in particular after the attack on 9/11. We've seen lots of information sharing between state, local, and federal forces, tactical and other kinds of training that's being shared, and also what's become incredibly popular lately is the 1033 program that was highlighted following the events in Ferguson of weapons being transferred.
Right. And, you know, the other thing I think is really important that you mentioned earlier was about I guess you didn't call it the opportunity cost. That's the part that got my interest, the changing specialties of people. It's almost unimaginable how much engineering brilliance goes into killing people, especially in the United States of America. And to think about if we just, you know, never mind a completely libertarian society or anything, but if we could just be a normal country in a normal time for a minute, it's, I think we would be shocked to find out just how powerful all that intellectual capital is that's been diverted from, you know, market purposes, like, I don't know, figuring out better ways to distribute food to hungry people or something like that, education to the needy. Instead, they're like locked down in a basement all day long, designing and redesigning and redesigning a gun for an armored personnel carrier or whatever madness just to destroy.
Absolutely. And this isn't something that we talk about in the paper, but the opportunity cost is absolutely significant. And it's really what's the incentive facing individuals who are engaging in these types of interventions. So one of the things in economics that we talk about is entrepreneurship. And what you're talking about is what is often known as constructive versus unproductive versus destructive entrepreneurship. And so the question is, what's more profitable for individuals to engage in? And so if it's more profitable for people to use their entrepreneurial talent to engage in market-oriented types of activities, you know, creating a new phone or building new goods and services for people to consume. If that's more profitable, people are going to pursue that end. On the other hand, as you were saying, if it's more profitable for people to design a new type of weapon or a new form of surveillance, then that's the kind of activity that people are going to be directed into. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know, speaking as a paranoid who's been really kind of freaking out about all the surveillance state, NSA Unleashed stuff since I was a kid, you know, at this point, it seems like, you know, it's all the worst nightmares come true. And it was so obvious from back then that there's so much government money behind the R&D for this stuff that, like, for example, biometric identification of people, which was just an idea that people talked about 25 years ago. It was pretty obvious that, oh, they're going to get this perfected as fast as they possibly can because the government has made it a priority. That, you know, forget competing in the market. If you're one of these level 35 computer genius types, you ought to be working for the Pentagon right now, helping develop iris scanners. And you know, there's profits to be made there that you can't beat in Silicon Valley.
Absolutely. And then you have individuals who not only are doing that, who not only engage in those types of things, but then figure out ways to market there are other ideas for the government. So if you actually go back to the origins of the NSA, for example, and this we talk about extensively in the paper, there was a man named Captain Ralph Van Diemen who actually was engaged in the U.S. occupation of the Philippines. This is all the way back in 1898. And as part of that assignment, he was responsible for really quashing the resistance to the U.S. occupation in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And the way that he and his colleagues went about this was engaging in really intensive surveillance tactics, getting people blacklisted, ruining their reputations, following people, telegraph tapping. And what wound up happening is when he returned to the U.S., he thought, hey, this is a really great idea, not just to use in the Philippines, but to use domestically. And he was a real champion, if you will, of setting up an intensive kind of security organization within the U.S. So the point's definitely well taken, and it's absolutely something worth thinking about.
Yeah, well, and I'm pretty sure that's what Mark Twain was referring to, since he, I think he had started out supporting the Spanish-American War, but then when it turned to conquering the Philippines, he figured it out real quick and joined up the Anti-Imperialist League and all of that. So he was, you know, our guy back then, and that this is exactly what he was talking about, you know, is just this kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Yep. And, that's what we need now is an anti-imperialist league. I'm thinking with a gigantic portrait of Mark Twain hanging in the background all the time, some giant auditorium full of millions of people. Anyway.
I like it.
All I need is billions of dollars, and I can get the millions of people together. It'll be easy.
If only.
Yeah.
I will say one of the things from the paper, though, because when we kind of got through the end of the paper, we were feeling really kind of like Debbie Downers of like, is there really nothing that we could do? And one of the things that we were thinking about is why is it that some interventions wind up coming back and really eroding civil liberties and others appear not to? And one of the things that we point to is the attitudes of citizens of the country whose government is engaging in the foreign intervention. So if U.S. citizens have a real aversion to a particular type of activity, then this could be a way that such interventions would wind up at least being a slower incursion, even if not eliminating it completely.
Right. Yeah, that's a very important point, too, that ultimately it really is up to us. And we saw a lot of backlash from Ferguson, a lot of people really surprised to find out all of a sudden just how militarized things had gotten from those images. So maybe right now we have a real window of opportunity to make our voices heard, along those lines. Great work here. I really appreciate it, Abigail.
Thank you very much.
That's Abigail Hall. She's at independent.org, wrote this with Christopher Coyne, Perfecting Tyranny. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And so the House and the Senate have voted for the Arm the Syrian Rebels bill with, I guess you could say, surprisingly high numbers of House members and senators voting no. Still passed, though, with ease. My brain's exploding over that one. I mean, I understand. Justin Raimondo has it exactly right in his article. You know, if you want to understand foreign policy, do not look from the point of view of what you think you would do because you love America and care about it and would try to do what is the right thing for the country. Because that's kind of ridiculous comic book thinking. That's not how it works. How it works is different constituencies demand what they want, and the ones who win get what they want. And so, in this case, this is ridiculous kind of hodgepodge policy of fighting ISIS and backing them. Although, you know, not really backing them, but sort of kind of backing them. Again, it's the real alternative to all of this intervention is to stop intervening. But to continue to support those who are fighting Assad, who is the quote-unquote president, really the dictator of what's left of Syria, and his army, that's just crazy. They are the only force capable of fighting ISIS. And now Robert Perry has a story today which is based on a single source. And, you know, I don't know. Robert Perry, he's a pretty good journalist, man. You got to give him some credit, I think. He has one source that says that Obama, you know, I don't know. Put this in your maybe. I said it's a single source story, okay? He admits, hey, it's a single source story. But here's what it is, that Obama's made a deal through Putin with the Syrians to allow American airstrikes in Syria without crying that it's a violation of their sovereignty, etc. Got to go through the motions of getting the permission, otherwise you got a problem there, kind of thing. And now I got to say, from the point of view of America is actually a country and there's anything like a national interest type of thing going on, that sure makes a hell of a lot more sense that, you know, oh yeah, backing the moderates is just, you know, PR. Yeah, we're going to train up, 5,000 of them over the course of a year in Saudi Arabia, far away, whatever, that's just smoke for really what they're doing is switching back to Assad. George W. Bush and Bill Clinton years where America helps Assad torture and kill jihadists. That's the old policy. That's the only thing that could possibly, and this is not a libertarian thing, it's not my position, but I'm just saying it's the kind of thing that will at least make sense from an American national interest point of view to reverse the ridiculous, insane, frankly, treasonous policy of the last 3 years to back the rebellion in Syria against Assad. The rebellion which has had at its core a bunch of Osama bin Ladenites declared loyal, sworn to Ayman al-Zawahiri and al-Qaeda. It's been madness this whole time. Reversing it would at least make sense. The policy of continuing to back the rebels, you know, I don't know. I got to tell you, again, there is no coherent policy here. There is no, you know, grand Freemason conspiracy or whatever that finally decides how all this is supposed to run and figures it out. It's just a bunch of, you know, yammering power mongers in the imperial court. And a lot of them are hell-bent still on getting regime change against Assad in Syria. I mean, John McCain the other day, to see John McCain on Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff's case, saying, listen, you want to back the Free Syrian Army that's been fighting Assad, and you want to turn them full scale against ISIS. Well, what if Assad attacks them? You don't want them to fight back against Assad? In other words, McCain was trying to basically say, you're really on the side of Assad, you bastard, when you should be regime changing him still. And McCain says to Dempsey, well, so what if Assad starts attacking them? You won't protect them? You'll just let them be slaughtered? And Dempsey doesn't know what to say about this. I mean, all I know what to say about it is something that Dempsey could certainly not say, which is, Mr. McCain, your treason on behalf of the Mujahideen in Syria has got to come to an end at some point. It's been a really, really bad policy. But now that ISIS is the sworn declared enemy ruling eastern Syria and western Iraq, your policy of attempting to regime change their worst enemy in the world has got to go. And frankly, sir, I can't believe that you would say this in a hearing like this, that you're still stuck on this. But, and it ain't just McCain. You know, it's the same kind of thing they did with Saddam Hussein. They built him up into Adolf Hitler. Yeah, well, Adolf Hitler at least was in control of Germany, huh? Saddam Hussein was only in charge of Iraq. Not much of a Hitler. His fourth largest army in the world was completely decimated by American air power and tank power at the dawn of the Gulf War in 1991 and never lived again. It was ridiculous. And Hussein, he was more of a Mussolini than a Hitler, to be perfectly legit about it. Although he had murdered a hell of a lot of Kurds and a hell of a lot of Shia. And he's a pretty brutal dictator. That was why Saddam Hussein worked so well with Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush in the 1990s before in the 1980s before H.W. Bush stabbed him in the back in 1990 and 1991. But anyway, the point is, they built him up into Adolf Hitler. George H.W. Bush said he's a Hitler. This guy, everywhere he goes, he's got Belgian babies on bayonets. He's going to kill us all. And they tested the focus groups. And I'm talking first Gulf War. They tested the focus groups, and the focus groups were still like, you know what, I've never heard of Kuwait, and I don't care who kills who in Kuwait. Honestly, I'm sorry. I'm really just not impressed. And they said, Saddam is going to make a nuclear bomb and kill you. Now are you impressed? And the focus groups said, uh-huh. And, you know, I'm sorry I don't have my footnote on that. I wonder, maybe chat room guys can help me. Maybe I'll try to Google that. Because I used to know that for a fact, that that was a real thing that happened. Let's see. 1990 Gulf War Focus Groups Nuclear. Gulf War. Well, it's hard to do this live. I'll see if I can find it. That's going to take some digging to find. They really did, you know, deliberately figure out, you got to threaten them with A-bombs. You threaten the Americans with A-bombs, they'll support a war. Then the consequence of that was, they could never make peace with Hussein again. They couldn't overthrow him and occupy Baghdad. Why, that would be insane. But then, they couldn't say, okay, you're a run-of-the-mill Mubarak, and you're a run-of-the-mill Gaddafi type, and we'll go ahead and let you back into the fold, more or less. You know, don't use any of the chemical weapons Ronald Reagan sold you on anybody anymore, and we'll let you live, whatever. They couldn't do that, especially not Bill Clinton, the Democrat, who would have been called a sissy, and of course couldn't stand that kind of criticism. And so, left Iraq under complete blockade for his entire presidency from bases in Saudi Arabia, motivating Al-Qaeda's war against America. First and foremost. Oh, yeah, see? Like the bumper music says, it's not justifying, it's just explaining. That's kind of how things work. Back in a second.
Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com.
All right, I'm Scott. I'm sorry, I never did work that back around to our tangent. From my tangent back to where I started from. So let's see how to segue that. Which became the excuse for Bush doing what his dad knew not to do, overthrowing and sacking Baghdad and creating Osama bin Ladenistan in the northwest of that country there. And then, of course, the blowback from that was that the Mujahideen went home to Syria and Libya, and in 2011 started rebellions, which then, amazingly, America got on the side of the rebels. Now, having to finally back down to the Democrats in the street in Cairo, finally, when Mubarak had no choice but to flee because the junior officers refused to fire on the protesters. And America finally accepting that fact and not just carpet bombing Cairo or something. Okay, that's one thing. But then turning around and getting on the side of the rebels, who are not a bunch of Democrats, but are a bunch of Mujahideen veterans of the Iraq War in Libya and Syria? Huh? And you know, I don't know. We talk about it on this show, and it is overly simplified, and I hate it when people talk about, oh, it's just a religious war. I mean, there are serious religious war aspects to the Sunni-Shia divide right now, but that's as the result of more than a decade of war at the hands of the United States of America, turning a sectarian, factional power political dispute into the kind of thing where now it's about, you know, who's a blasphemer and an unbeliever and all of this kind of thing. You know, the Iraqi Sunnis, ever since the Americans and the Iranians, you know, started putting the, Shiite parties in power in Baghdad, have referred to those Iraqis, those Shiite Iraqi parties as the Iranians, which is totally unfair and not true because most of them are Iraqis, of course. They're, yeah, I mean, they're sock puppets, the Iranians, but they call all Shia the Iranians. Well, now, under ISIS, they're not considered Iranians. They're considered Shiite, evil, heretical people who must be completely destroyed and this kind of thing, which was not what the fight was about previously. And it now is becoming about that because really it's part of the strategy of ISIS to create that level of conflict so that they can thrive in it. But so it gets so dressed up in all that religious stuff. But then you hear, just kind of as a matter of conventional wisdom, oh, they've been fighting about this for 700 years or 1,200 years or whatever it is. It's always been this way, the Sunni versus the Shia and whatever. No, no, no. You spelled 2003 wrong. I mean, yes, it's true. Again, the Sunnis dominated the Shia in Iraq, but it wasn't a massive religious thing. It was more of a in-group, out-group thing just as a matter of identity. If you understand. But when you hear people say, oh, they've been fighting about this age-old, century-long conflict between Sunni and Shia, what they're really saying is, not America's fault, but that's a damn lie. It's a nice excuse for all the chaos that's taken place there. But then, so for all the talk about that, I swear I'm getting to my point. For all the talk about that on this show, because it is a real matter of, you know, not just the religious war, but the factional dispute over who's on whose side here is very much on sectarian lines. And yet, like in the conversation with Michael Scheuer yesterday, where he talked about just what kind of incompetent boobs run America, it's sort of kind of within the realm of possibility that even if you have at the think tanks, people who are saying and writing smart things about how these things are, at the accepted think tanks, you know, the establishment ones. That doesn't necessarily mean these thoughts are making their way into the conversations of the people doing the deciding at all. Like, for example, and I'm just making this, you know, I'm speculating kind of a thing. But I'm just saying, to me, it's within the realm of possibility that, like, when you have a conversation between Hillary Clinton, Leon Panetta, Barack Obama, and David Petraeus, he was the head of the CIA, Panetta, DOD, Hillary, Secretary of State, first Obama administration, hear him saying, their little national security meeting about what to do. And Hillary and Panetta and Petraeus have their consensus. They want to push hard to back the rebels in Syria against Assad. Unlike, I mean, in Libya, it's backing the Mujahideen, and that's insane. But in this case, it's backing the Mujahideen in a sectarian war. Whereas in Libya, it wasn't so sectarian, I guess, except for the poor blacks who got completely screwed. But anyway, I wonder whether Obama, his national security advisor, was it Don Elon or whatever at the time? Or is anyone in the room saying, now, wait a minute, there's a massive sectarian war in the region, and which all sides are we on now? And if, as Hillary said on CBS News in the beginning of 2012, if backing the rebellion in Syria amounts to backing Al-Qaeda in Syria, isn't that treason? Maybe we're doing the wrong thing. I know Israel really hates Assad and really would like us to marginalize a weakened Assad, but how risky is it, guys, do you think? CIA Director Petraeus, have you done a study about just how dangerous this might be if we back a Mujahideen Sunni-based insurgency in Syria, the same kind we just finished defeating or, well, bribing out of existence in Iraq and yada-da? Did they even have an honest discussion of this at all? Or was it all politics, even in the room at the time? Now, how the hell do they decide these insane policies? It's just insane. Yes, the Israel lobby really wants us to hurt Assad. But? Can we have a but? And a little bit more discussion beyond that? Please? Obama sided with the Sunni-based insurgency. Obama sided with the enemy from the Iraq war. The last Iraq war. He sided with them in Syria. On the other side of the line. I've been saying this for 3 years straight, too. By the way. And so, yeah, I mean, and all the pressure in politics, all the pressure in Washington, D.C., all the pressure on cable TV news this whole time has been, why won't he do more to help the rebels, these mythical moderate rebels? Why won't he do more to regime change Assad? Boy, that Barack Obama, always leading from behind. He just won't do what it takes to get rid of the only force keeping ISIS from the Mediterranean Sea. The last Middle Eastern state in the region where it's still legal to get a drink. It's amazing to me that this is how it goes, but this is how it goes. And I've said it before, I'll say it again. What George Bush did by invading Iraq and getting rid of clean-shaven chin Saddam with the black beret in favor of a bunch of jihadist warlords was the greatest thing he could have ever done for Osama bin Laden, times a million what bin Laden could have ever imagined, the benefits for his goals being carried out. But Obama has outright taken the side of Al-Qaeda and affiliated groups in Libya and in Syria. Beat that, W. You dumbass. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Still coming up on the show, Dar Jamail and the other Scott Horton. We'll be on to talk about different aspects of the new Iraq war. Yeah. So, yeah, as mind-blowing as it is that Obama has doubled down on Bush's policy of doing exactly what Osama bin Laden would have had him do, although Bush did it accidentally because he's a stupid freaking idiot, Obama's deliberately done it. And then this is the part, the reason I didn't mention it is because even though I'm living through it right now with you, there's this cognitive dissonance where I just can't believe it almost because I just can't believe it. But they continue to double down on this policy, seemingly. The House and the Senate just passed Obama's requested bill to authorize $500 million to fund more rebels to continue to oppose Assad. And now, oh no, they must all shave every day and forswear ever, you know, swearing allegiance to Zawahiri until they get back to Syria. And I don't really know. Like I was saying, I kind of suspect, part of me has to suspect, that nah, they're switching back to Assad. They have to switch back to Assad. That's some, create a third force army of 5,000 guys that's supposed to fight Assad and al-Nusra and al-Sham and ISIS in a year. Just because it's stupid doesn't mean it's not the plan. It's really stupid. I admit I don't know. I'm walking you through what I'm thinking here. But it sure does seem like the policy is still to back the traitors. And now here's the thing. You could argue, and I concede that there's a slight bit of slippery slope argument to what I'm saying here, but not much. And so the slippery slope part would be, come on, show me where the CIA is directly arming and training actual ISIS guys. I can't show you that. I haven't seen that. On the other hand, from the very broadest sense, America's been supporting the rebellion there and has been helping and approving of our allies supporting the rebellion there. America's responsible. And then as you narrow it down, look at who Qatar and Turkey and Saudi have been backing here. You know, they say Qatar backs the more Muslim Brotherhood groups. I don't know. I don't hear much from them. Saudi backs Ahrar al-Sham predominantly, which is basically the Islamic Front, which got their entire leadership suicide bombed off the face of the earth the other day, last week, I guess. Not that they're completely gone, because as we see, cut the head off the snake, it's fine, it's an insurgency. Ahrar al-Sham. And then the Turks have been favoring Jabhat al-Nusra, those who are sworn loyal to Zawahiri first. Zawahiri is Osama bin Laden's best buddy, the Egyptian surgeon, the guy behind the far enemy, you and me policy. And so as Hillary Clinton explained, the narrative has always been, why aren't we doing more to help the rebels? And no one can say, because it's treason. We don't have to ally with Iran and Assad to still be too smart to deliberately help the Mujahideen against them, for Christ's sake. But here, so Hillary Clinton, defending herself from the accusation that she's not doing enough, says, hey, listen, if this is Al-Qaeda's rebellion in Syria, then are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria? And that's a rhetorical question, but she is clearly saying, yeah, I mean, that's the danger anyway, right?
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria? Hamas is now supporting the opposition. Are we supporting Hamas in Syria?
So, I don't, you know, the Hamas thing is a red herring there. But, you know, and that's what, and in fact, she goes on to say.
So I think Wyatt, you know, despite the great pleas that we hear from those people who are being ruthlessly assaulted by Assad, if you're a military planner or if you're a secretary of state and you're trying to figure out, do you have the elements of an opposition that is actually viable, we don't see that.
There you go. And that's been the case ever since. That was the beginning of 2012. And so there she's conceding my point completely. That for them to support the rebellion is to, in effect, support the goals of America's enemies. And And then you can read it in the Washington Post and you can read it in the New York Times. I mention them because they are the most mainstream and acceptable official organs of official journalism in America and all of that. And even they concede that the, as they put it, the majority of the aid that the CIA has been coordinating for the rebels in Syria has gone to the jihadi groups. And why do you think that is? Because they're the ones who don't mind dying. So they're the ones who are doing the fighting. And that's the way it's been this whole time. And they've admitted that even. That, yeah, Jabhat al-Nusra is basically just al-Qaeda in Iraq. Yeah, we know. They've said that all along. And then even David Sanger, of all people, David Sanger at the New York Times, says, hey, look, the aid that we're given is ending up in the hands of the suicide bombers and the prisoner beheaders. And so, yes, it's true that Obama's not given them everything they want in order that they can absolutely overthrow Assad. But so what's he done instead? Give them just enough to help get a few hundred thousand people killed in a long-term, no-win, grinding civil war and ended up creating the space for ISIS to take over. And what ISIS did is just get smart. At least for the time being, we'll see how well it works overall, but they said we would rather have a state. So we're going to take over the territory that Assad already doesn't control, and we're just going to declare a state there. And if al-Nusra and the Islamic Front and the FSA and whatever want to keep fighting Assad, fine. But we're going to focus on building up our state here, just because why throw your guys up against a brick wall? And so they started building up their state, and but so now, at least they would have us believe that the best future for Syria that America can make for them is to continue to back the rebels who are trying to overthrow Assad, which means, of course, that in overthrowing Assad, they would overthrow the entire government of Syria, would be destroyed, just like during the war in Iraq in 2003, the war in Libya in 2011. It would be a brand new country, only now without the participation of the Alawites, the Shiites, which the Alawites are sort of kind of Shiites, but they're also different. So anyway, the Druze, and I don't know if there are any Jews left anyway. But the Chaldean and the Assyrian Christians and the Kurds and everybody who, and a hell of a lot of Sunnis too, will have no position in power at all because, you know, ultimately, for now anyway, the momentum is with ISIS against al-Nusra or any of these other groups. If Damascus falls, it'll be just like when Baghdad falls. And you turn the whole country into lawless jihadistan. It's almost unbelievable. I mean, you'd think I'm lying, but then you turn on TV and they're saying, you know, geez, maybe we shouldn't fight ISIS after all. Because it'll help Iran and Syria. We can't have that. What? Iran and Syria never did anything to America. Iran and Syria aren't enemies of America. It'll accidentally benefit them if we attack the guys who are sworn to attack us. And I'm not saying, you know, I'm supporting the war, but I'm saying the side benefit to Iran and Assad at this point is ridiculous. And we shouldn't be doing anything in the war. And we shouldn't be allying with Iran or with Syria. But, I mean, hey, David Frum, the guy that wrote The Right Man, Hagiography of George W. Bush, he wrote a thing in The Atlantic, you know, like he's some kind of peacenik, saying we should not go to war with the Islamic State. Not because it'll blow up in our face, it'll make them stronger, it'll make Americans targets of terrorist attacks. No, because it'll strengthen Assad and the Ayatollah, relatively speaking, in the region. Can you believe that? In September of 2014, these guys are still...
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you guys.
I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up, Dar Jamail. And also the other Scott Horton, heroic anti-torture international human rights lawyer, professor at Columbia University. He'll be on the show. And yeah, so that should be good. Oh, the Scotland thing. Man, I'm really disappointed that the Scottish are not declaring independence. I don't know. Wait a minute. How come 55% get to decide for 45 again? I mean, I guess there are worse ways of doing business, but yeah. I'm just pro-secession. And whether it was a crooked vote or not, I saw someone brought up in the chat room. I don't know. I mean, fair to speculate about any vote anywhere in the world, whether it was actually done well or not. I don't know if anybody has any particular tales to tell about irregularities or anything, but usually, I don't know, when it's a 10-point split, that's pretty hard to fake. Usually, you know, a vote has to be pretty damn close anyway to steal it. You got a margin of maybe 1% or 2% you can push, but it depends on the particular election, I guess. But anyway, you know, most people are going to vote for the status quo unless they got a real reason to change it. Light and transient causes, as Jefferson phrased it. Too bad. I got a little Scottish in me. I'd have been happy to see the... And it doesn't matter if I do or not. I'd have been happy to see him secede from the UK. I'd have been happy to see the UK taking down a peg. You know, the UK government. I don't care so much about their civilization either way, but I just mean their state deserves to be weakened and humiliated. And it's too bad that the chance has been lost for now. I guess that's all I got to say about that, because I don't know much more about it. So, yeah, man, I didn't even look at the Israel-Palestine section on antiwar.com today. I was trying to get a hold of Max Blumenthal, man. Whatever happened to that? I wanted to hear about all his time he spent weeks in the Gaza Strip reporting on the aftermath of the war there. And yeah, it was a war. It was a very one-sided war, but it was a war. And, you know, I'd like to know about, you know, the aftermath in terms of the ceasefire, too. So how are things at the Rafah border crossing now? Better? Are they allowing construction to move forward on some of the construction projects they promised to allow to move forward? Are they backing off of the farmland, the very best land that happens to be at the razor wire fence border there, and allowing people back onto it? Or, you know, the terms of the ceasefire, are the Israelis living up to it? Them. I would like to know. Anyway, so, well, I'm sorry, I'm falling down on the job there. I'll try to get some good journalism about the aftermath of the war on the show for you next week. If not Max Blumenthal, I guess somebody else reporting out of there. And then, you know, I think I want to rant and rave a little bit. Nah, I should save this for the other Scott Horton interview. Yeah, my Scotty Generals. Oh, by the way, I was reminiscing an anecdote, and I couldn't think of my footnote the other day on the show. I thought it was something that somebody said to me. But now I don't think that anymore. Because I got an email from an old friend who said, ah, you're talking about Gore Vidal. And I thought to myself, I think that's right. I didn't double check. But I thought, yeah, that sounds right. That it was Gore Vidal who talked about his grandfather, the general, musing that, you know, him and the other generals on the weekend would talk about, eh, we really don't like FDR. Maybe we'll just cross the river and go kick him right out of his chair. And that he kind of grew up under that. The threat of a military coup d'etat in Washington, D.C. when he was a little boy. That was how he learned about what it's like to, you know, observe power up close. A very young age. I learned about politics from Star Wars, you know. He learned about politics from his
would-be military dictator of America grandfather, I guess, who never did act on it. He would just get drunk and smoke cigars and go on about his day, I suppose. But I do believe that my friend in the email is right there, that that's who I couldn't think of as the person who told that story, that that was Gore Vidal. Plenty of reason to hate FDR, but you wouldn't want the military to overthrow him. The bastard. All right, let's see. This is an important story that I meant to talk about that I did not get to. Speaking of Syria, and this is all over Twitter now. They got pictures of the refugees. ISIS seizes Syrian Kurdish villages, attacks border city. 21 villages fell in the last 24 hours, and that was written last night. Despite the indications that ISIS forces in Raqqa were moving underground in anticipation of U.S. attacks, the group continues to remain on the offensive across northern Syria and is once again pressing Kurdish territory. ISIS has reportedly taken 21 Kurdish villages in the past 24 hours and is once again mounting an offensive against the oft-threatened Kurdish border city of Ain al-Arab. The Kurdistan Workers' Party, PKK, those are the communists rather than the Peshmerga, has once again issued a call to arms, which the Peshmerga, they're from the Kurdistan Workers' Party, so they're pretty much communists too, I guess. I don't know. Such calls have worked in the past at securing large numbers of volunteer fighters. Oh, I skipped it. The Kurdistan Workers' Party has once again issued a call to arms to Kurds in both Syria and Turkey to defend Ain al-Arab. Such calls have worked in the past at securing large numbers of volunteer fighters to fend off ISIS threats. As the fighting ratchets up around the city, an unidentified drone looms overhead. The drone is likely to be part of U.S. surveillance operations in the area in anticipation of expanding the air war into Syria. So that's Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com right there. I learned about politics from Harry Brown, too, to a great degree there, chat room dude, who also loves Harry Brown like me. You know, I got to shake hands with Harry Brown at that same Libertarian Party convention in 2004 that I mentioned, where so many Libertarian Party leaders were so terrible on the war when they should have been the greatest American heroes on it. Suckers. But anyway, Harry Brown was great on the war. Harry Brown was great on the war from September 12th on. He wrote that essay the night of the 11th, really. When will we ever learn, it's called. And Harry Brown was great, and I met him, and I had the idea that he was really old, and I probably wouldn't get a chance to actually shake hands with him in person again. So I shook his hand like 10 different times when I saw him at that thing. It was becoming kind of a comical, not quite really obnoxious, but okay, really? Okay, yeah, one more time. All right, good to shake hands with you. Good to see you. And I got a picture, but then you know what I did is I didn't even understand computers well enough at the time. I saved the JPEG as this tiny little thing and didn't give it a new name, and I overwrote this awesome picture that I had of me and Harry Brown with some tiny little very low resolution picture that I have of me and him. But anyway, he was great, and I interviewed him at least twice, I think maybe three or four times on the show back during the weekend interview show. He really was a great libertarian. Very, very anti-war. He was actually writing a book about the war racket, it was called. It may have ended up being published in part at some point or something. But he was still at the World War I part at the time when he died, or when he quit writing shortly before he died. Anyway, yeah, good old Harry Brown, man. He was awesome. And, why government doesn't work. I know, isn't it great? Yeah, why government doesn't work. You don't even need all the scandals about, yeah, but the CIA are the ones bringing in the cocaine, or, yeah, but Barack Obama's the one who's been supporting the Mujahideen, or any of that kind of craziness. All you need is just this kind of basic principles of the functioning of the state. How it works guarantees that it can't work. It fails because it's a failure of a system of human social organization. Yeah. Harry Brown, why government doesn't work. Great one. Especially if you're young and you need to like be able to get this done in 1 week or whatever, you know, a couple of days. Sit down, read that book. You'll be smarter after that. Okay, good. And conservatives who think you like Harry Brown, yeah, everything he says applies to foreign policy too. And no, you're not smarter than him where you disagree with him about foreign policy. He's smarter than you. Okay, good. Thanks. And when I say conservative, I'm sorry. Some of you guys are anti-war, but as you know, not most. So that's what I meant. Thank goodness for you, this segment is over. But hang tight, Dar Jamail's coming up, and then the other Scott Horton on the Scott Horton Show. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our next guest today is Dar Jamail. He's the author of Beyond the Green Zone and The Courage to Resist. He was an unembedded reporter in the last Iraq war, and he's still a hell of an expert on the next one, the new war. Welcome back. How are you doing, Dar?
Hey, thanks, Scott. Good to be with you.
Very good to have you here. It's darjamail.com, right?
.net.
.net. Sorry. Here, let me write that down. Okay, yeah. So, I guess I'll just ask you what you think of the president's strategy for taking on the Islamic State. He says he's going to destroy it. He's not going to use any ground troops to do it, but he's got a coalition together. And they're going to back the rebels in Syria, and they're going to back the inclusive new government in Baghdad, and they're going to whoop up on these ISIS guys. What do you say?
What strategy? That would in some be my response. I mean, you and I, Scott, for now, what, going on almost a decade, have been amazed in talking about the folly of one U.S. administration after another of what they've done. Of course, the Bush administration, it was so easy to watch what they were doing. But now I would argue that just in the same way as inane as the Obama administration's so-called strategy is, that what's different? I mean, now they're trying to regurgitate a plan, basically Bush's surge strategy, which was all about tying in with regurgitating a plan that Saddam Hussein used to try to control restive provinces like Anbar, Nineveh, etc., by finding tribal sheikhs who will play ball, front them a whole lot of money in order to have them control their fighters under their control and to keep them from going after the government. And that's basically what the U.S. is looking at now in Baghdad, of trying to get, basically break it down on a province level to try to get various provinces again to kind of a reiteration of the Sunni awakening strategy to go after these guys, coupled with ongoing airstrikes in Syria, direct collaboration with the Assad government, which is an amazing feat for them to have pulled off on the ground as well as politically. And what's changing on the ground? They're not having any success so far with any of these so-called strategies. And of course, we know, history shows us, and we've talked about this repeatedly, that airstrikes are only going to make things worse, and that's exactly what we're seeing.
Oh, well, there's just no doubt about that. I mean, unless they're, you know, they would have us imagine these pictures that we've seen of convoys of Toyotas out on the highway where there's no collateral damage around. Go ahead and strafe the hell out of these guys. It looks like a lot of fun, but that's not really what we're talking about. We're talking about airstrikes on cities full of people who have not necessarily, you know, joined up to be fighters for ISIS at all.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and guaranteed and for blowback there.
Right, exactly. So there again, that's why we have all these people on the ground giving either direct or indirect support or sympathy to ISIS, because they're being attacked by either U.S. airstrikes or the government in Baghdad. And that's why they're getting their strength. And so when you just simply increase those tactics, which is exactly what the Obama administration is doing, let's get more arms into Baghdad for that government. Let's increase our airstrikes. Let's look at the possibility of using our own ground troops there, and that's yet to be determined. And all of that just feeds straight into what ISIS wants, which is, you know, the more you come after us, the more local support we're going to have, because the more people are going to depend upon us for their own security and to keep the Baghdad government troops out of their area, which is a really key pivotal play, because that's essentially what got ISIS into Iraq and gave them the foothold that they enjoyed from the very, very beginning, because people were across Western Iraq, mainly the Sunni population, were under direct ongoing assault from the government of Baghdad, and that's not stopping.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and you know, it was clear, I guess hardly anybody noticed this. I guess maybe I didn't recognize exactly how big of a deal it was at the time, but I mean, I certainly took note and incorporated into my understanding of how things were going there. And that was, more than a year ago now, say like a year and 3 months ago, Patrick Coburn reported on the withdrawal of huge parts of the Iraqi army. I don't know exactly, divisions, brigades, this, that, the other, but many members of the Iraqi army, like units or whatever they were, withdrew from areas near Mosul anyway, up in the northwest, because it just wasn't their territory, and they didn't feel like they had the support from Baghdad to be out there. And so this was sort of, you know, the fall of Mosul before it fell, you know, where parts of the, in other words, the de facto separation, the giving up by Baghdad of Sunnistan was already in process, at least, you know, in effect, before ISIS even came back across the border a year later to declare a state. They already had, you know, that little influence over there at that time. But now, so, and a big part of that, of course, is like you're referring to the awakening movement there. The Maliki government never lived up to their end of the bargain that will keep all of you guys on the dole in, you know, the way Petraeus had put them on it. As long as you promise not to fight us, we'll incorporate you into the security forces, whatever, whatever. The Maliki government never wanted to meet those benchmarks, never did meet them, and so it's kept them frozen out. Now, I have to say, when I hear you talk about how part of the strategy is to redo the awakening movement, I'm saying, hey, at least that makes sense. I hadn't even heard that. But if they wanted to say that, like, hey, the natural enemy of ISIS is the Sunni population they're attempting to foist their rule on, that actually has precedent. As you said, it worked for Saddam. It worked for Petraeus in a way. To turn the tribes against the Islamists, to marginalize them. After all, they are kind of totalitarian monsters and don't really make a lot of friends everywhere they go, engender a lot of popular support wherever they go. And so, you know, at least that would make sense. But I wonder whether you think that Abadi and the new government in Baghdad are even going to try that. I mean, obviously, the Americans don't have enough of a presence there to engineer a kind of Sawa, whatever the hell, like Petraeus did. But can the Abadi government, will the Abadi government even try to bring the tribes and Sunni stamp back into the Baghdad fold, or that ship is already long sailed, or what?
Well, that's it. And it, I think it's a situation where it's a strategy that might look good on paper and make some logical sense, as you just described. But
I mean, compared to backing the rebels in Syria still, for example, which is complete la-la land.
Right. But I mean, if we just play out some of the roadblocks in front of basically the Awakening Council's part two, first of all, how can you convince these guys who, you know, tens of thousands of them literally have been killed either directly by Maliki's forces or current government forces or radical fighters or other former Iraqi resistance fighters, their families killed off, so many of them pushed out of their homes, pushed out of the country altogether. We're talking about tens of thousands. For years, these guys weren't ever paid, yet continued doing their security positions, hoping against hope they would eventually get paid. So how do you take what's left of that force that's been screwed over in every way possible and convince them, hey, look, this time it's going to be different, even though the Americans aren't here directly? As they were previously, even though they're not the ones making the massive cash drop-offs to the sheikhs in charge of you anymore, even though we have a new government, a new leader of the government in Baghdad, but we really don't have proof yet that they're handling things very differently. Despite all that, trust us. How's that going to work?
Yeah. In other words, the benchmarks were supposed to be accomplished back in 2007, and it was too late then, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, mm-hmm. As we see by the result. And we see why, too, because Bush took away any incentive that the Shia parties had to compromise with the Sunnis, because screw you, we already got Baghdad. So what are you going to do about it? And they were the, quote, strong Federalists, like Abdulaziz al-Hakim were the ones that America backed. And so, and the Dawa Party, you know, basically in concert with the Supreme Islamic Council. So they got what they wanted. George W. Bush, Shiistan in the South. So why bribe the Sunnis? Go ahead and suffer under the Islamic State. What does Baghdad care about that? Oh, man. And now I talked all the way up until the Sanford Sun started playing. Hey, listen, everybody. I'm on the phone with Dar Jamail. Well, Skype, but so to speak, you understand? And when we get back, I'm going to try to talk less and ask him more questions and see what he thinks about the serious side of this so-called strategy, too. Switching back to Assad or still pushing regime change against Assad? More in a minute. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Talking with Dar Jamail about Iraq War 3. It's amazing to me. It's not just Dar. It's everyone who knows anything about Iraq is saying, oh my God, pardon me, I have some objections to how this is supposed to work here. People seem to believe in the Iraq side of the strategy a little bit more because at least the government of Baghdad is asking for our help. And, oh, that makes things much simpler. Well, yeah, not so much, as you've been hearing. And but on the Syrian side, everyone agrees in every major news story about it that this makes no sense whatsoever. There are no moderates, and even if there were, you're going to train 5,000 of them for a year, and then they're going to be able to take on Assad, Hezbollah, the al-Nusra Front, the Islamic Front, Ahrar al-Sham, and the Islamic State all at the same time, huh? A year, starting a year from now, huh? And what moderates are you supposed to be doing this with? And this is what everyone is asking. All up and down Twitter, all of the most kind of mainstream conventional thinking, you know, pseudo experts and somewhat experts on this, everyone is just saying, this is crazy. How is this supposed to work? Dar, what do you think?
One of the classic definitions of insanity is doing the same behavior over and over and expecting a different result.
You have no idea how many times my different guests have said that to me in the last just month. Probably like 10 different times.
I know.
And it's not you repeating yourself. It's all of my different guests keep saying that. Sometimes they mention Einstein. Sometimes they don't.
It's hard not to because it's so... amazing to me that we're watching these major events play out on the international stage. This is, again, one of the biggest ongoing stories on almost a daily basis. And they are literally recycling and regurgitating the same strategies, trying to make it look as though it's new somehow, and selling it to people and trying to make it look as though this is going to be effective and this is what we're doing to solve the problem. I mean, it's as absurd as, you know, a Daily Mash story recently, which they're basically, for those in the U.S. listening, that's the U.K. equivalent of The Onion, a satirical online magazine. And they basically ran a story that said, hey, you know, the U.S. has done all these airstrikes and immediately following them, peace has broken out across the Middle East.
Right.
I mean, because that's basically what their strategy presupposes that we're supposed to believe that is going to happen. And so now, how is this strategy of the newly announced strategy, so-called strategy, that we're going to take this certain number of rebels, train them very specifically for the next year, and turn them loose? How is that any different in any way than what they've already done?
Right. By the way, it sounds like your microphone maybe is rubbing up against your shirt or your beard or something like that there. Little bit of interference. Just want to make sure we're as clear as we can be for the rest as we go forward here. But now, so I got this weird theory about the war here, and I guess we've talked about this somewhat. A lot of what you've said has helped help me informing my own thoughts about all this. It seems to me like we're in this kind of weird situation where ISIS is one of the weaker states in the world. They got the crappiest part of Iraq. They have very little revenue and they have absolutely no legitimacy in terms of cooperation with any other state in the world. Nothing official anyway. No kind of official trade relationship or diplomatic recognition from any other of the 190-something countries in the world. They're completely isolated, they're completely landlocked, and they're surrounded by, you know, deadly enemies. People who are absolutely sworn to their destruction, like the Shia of southern Iraq, the Iranians, and their other Assad and their other enemies around them. And so it seems like... But the problem is, if America intervenes to help any of those actual groups move in to Islamic State territory, the new caliphate territory, to try to overthrow them, that is likely to blow up in our face. If we back Assad, then that's a really big deal, because then we're siding with Tehran, et cetera, et cetera. And same thing, really, if we back the Iraqi army or the Shiite militias, if we, you know, back the Kurds to try to come in. I don't think the Kurds could really sack Mosul anyway, but if we tried to get them to do that, then there's all the other consequences come from that. So it seems like we have them almost perfectly helpless, perfectly surrounded, and if we do anything, we'll make them stronger. The best thing, never mind from a libertarian, principled non-interventionist point of view, but just from a utilitarian point of view, it looks to me, the best thing to do is sit here and do absolutely nothing and let the local tribal system turn on them eventually, which should be pretty soon. What do you think?
I would agree with that, and then add that, you know, but that's where the Obama administration and, of course, the administration before it have made themselves such an amazing bed right smack in the middle of this mess, because now internationally on the political stage, they have to appear as though they're doing something. Because everyone knows this is all, you know, the genesis of all of this is the U.S. involvement there from 2003 and, of course, well before that. But we're at fault, we're responsible, so ergo, we have to appear as though we're doing something. And they can't, as you just said, you know, anything they do is going to make it worse, and that's exactly what we're seeing playing out. But I would agree. I think it's the only solution is going to be a local solution with no direct involvement from the West whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And instead, again, of course, we're seeing the opposite. And I think that that's actually an extremely good description and explanation of why and how everything continues to go worse and will continue to go worse.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been saying that kind of thing over and over again. And I keep ticking off, you know, the Shiites and the Alawites and the different reasons why we ought to not back them. But, you know, Michael Scheuer was on the show yesterday and he mentioned how, well, what if we bring in an army of these kind of secular sock puppets, or not maybe secular, but these sock puppet Sunni regimes like the Saudis or the Egyptians in there? Oh, man, that's even better than for ISIS. That's even better than bringing in and being the Air Force for the Iranians. If you're going to be the Air Force for the sock puppet sellout, Western belly crawling traitor, sock puppet dictators, that's just going to be the ultimate in discrediting them and crediting ISIS. So, you know, a good thing the Saudis don't fight any of their wars. We fight all their wars for them, or that could be a real problem.
That, but yeah, and oh boy, would that make things even much more complicated. But you know, the other, you know, two things I want to leave folks with before we wrap up our time together today.
Real quick, and now, sorry, I talked too much.
The, you know, we have to keep in mind, you know, we're looking at over 100 Iraqis being killed almost every single day. Today alone, almost 200 killed and almost the same number again wounded in airstrikes and attacks across the country. We have to remember how many Iraqis are suffering directly from all of this. That is the bottom line, the most important thing underneath everything that we're talking about here. And it's all a direct result of U.S. policy in the region that's gone on now for decades. We have to remember that. And the other thing, too, is just to remember that the Obama administration and all these so-called strategies and plans moving forward, this is all evidence of an administration that does not know what it's doing, does not have a solution to this problem. And that's why everything they're doing is going to continue to make it worse. And we can expect this thing to be the juggernaut and the elephant in the room going forward, especially as we continue to get into campaign season for the 2016 presidential election. And this is going to be a deal breaker in that so-called election as we move forward towards that as well.
Yep. It seems like everybody in every party who has any chance whatsoever at the presidency is on board for it, too. So they'll all just be out hawking each other. I can't wait. Hey, thanks very much, Dar. You're the best, dude.
Thanks a lot, Scott. Always a pleasure.
That's Dar Jamail, everybody. It's at darjamail.net. We'll be right back with the other Scott Horton in just a sec.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and so's my guest. He's the other Scott Horton, no relation. But he's a heroic anti-torture international human rights attorney, former chair of the New York Bar Association's committees on human rights and on international law. He's a professor of law at Columbia University. He's a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, and he's the author of the new book, Lords of Secrecy. Oh, wait. I hope that wasn't a secret, was it, Scott? Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
No, great. I'm thankful for the plug. I'm doing fine.
Okay, great. I'm so sorry I haven't read this thing yet. My pile of books, if it fell on me, I'd be a dead man. And those are just the ones I haven't gotten to yet. The ones I've read, well, that's an entirely different story. But yeah, Lords of Secrecy. Can't wait to read this. And I already hear back that others really like it, too. So that's good. Can't wait to read it. It's Lords of Secrecy, the National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. Hey, that's a good subtitle. And is this thing published yet or available yet, or what's the deal?
It's going into print next month.
Next month. Okay, great. And then so we can expect to see it at Amazon.com then or later?
Yeah, in fact, the page is already up there at Amazon.com. You can check on it, and you can put in the pre-order.
There you go. Hey, do that, everybody. Support other Scott's work. It's guaranteed to be good work. Come on. All right. So, Lords of Secrecy, indeed. Hey, let's talk about the new war. Along with secrecy goes the impunity of the modern American empire. And as we speak, John Kerry himself is sitting in for Samantha Power and is chairing a meeting of the United Nations Security Council on the issue of the war against ISIS. Now, my understanding is they're not seeking a UN resolution and consensus with Russia and China on this war against ISIS, a UN resolution to start a war. They're claiming they already have the authority regardless of the UN on this. Is that correct? Or what do you think?
Yeah, I would say this is typical to some extent. That is, when you're not sure you're going to get UN support, you don't say you have to have it. And that's the situation they're in now, where it's not entirely clear. I'd say as a matter of international law, quite apart from U.S. law or constitutional law, the sort of military intervention that they're carrying out, they can probably do it consistent with international law in Iraq because they've got the Iraqi government inviting them in and saying, go at it. But their position in Syria is a lot less clear. I'd say a pretty strong case that what they're doing without UN approval is not lawful.
Mm. Well, and you know, it's interesting because there's a report today. It is a single sourced report, but Robert Perry, I think, does a real good job. It's worth mentioning. He says that America has a secret deal now through the Russians with Assad to go ahead and allow us to bomb. Maybe they'll come to more of an official understanding on that later. But, you know, as though it's really, I guess, legally speaking, it is up to him to give America permission to bomb eastern Syria. Correct.
That's right. I mean, you know, there is a lawful government in Syria. That's Assad's for the moment. They're recognized by the UN. They're accredited. And that means that if they say it's okay, then as a matter of international law, it is okay for the U.S. to come in and bomb ISIS.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, so maybe we'll get back to the UN and the international politics of the war and all that in a minute, but I want to kind of rewind to the beginning of this discussion that we kind of skipped over just because of the immediate news here about Kerry at the UN right now, about the war powers, because there's been a lot of controversy about this, and even one of Bush's lawyers who helped legalize not the very worst abuses, but was still, you know, part and parcel of a lot of some of the bad stuff from the Bush era, Jack Goldsmith, wrote a thing for Time magazine. Just shocked. He sounds exactly like Marjorie Cohen at Truthout about
the abrogation of war power here by the President of the United States. And so I guess I wanted to start with actually the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, and whether that is, as Henry Hyde said back in 03 to Ron Paul, just an anachronism and not part of the Constitution that we have to follow anymore. Is that really right, that just, you know, presidents can start war? What they usually say is, well, the War Powers Act updates Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11, and says that the president can start a war for 60 days if he wants. Is that right? What the hell?
Well, I think the fact that we're 230 years into this Constitution and we can have such arguments tells you right off the bat that the Constitution is not a model of clarity on this issue. It certainly isn't. And I would say what is – and I'm, by the way, I'm with Jack Goldsmith on this. Oddly enough, I disagree with him on almost everything else. But I would say we are in or approaching a constitutional crisis in the United States about the presidential use of war powers. And that is, while it's never been terribly clear in the law, it has been reasonably clear that the president has the power or authority to take defensive action. If the country's attacked, he can defend the country, he can launch a riposte, things of that sort. But if he's launching a sustained offensive action on the territory of another state, his authority is circumscribed by a requirement that he has the approval of Congress, okay? So the first point is, does that mean he has to have a declaration of war from Congress? And the answer on that point is definitely not. So, you know, the clause in the Constitution that gives Congress the right to declare war, well, Congress does have that right, but that doesn't dispose of this whole war-making ability. And if we look at things historically, you know, Congress has exercised its right of co-determination on the issue many, many different ways, by passing resolutions, by appropriating funds, and by declaring war, for instance. But Congress has to be involved. And I think what we're seeing in the last several years is a pretty consistent circumvention of Congress, so that Congress is really playing no role. And I would go back to 2011 in Libya and look at what happened there. I mean, we never had congressional action authorizing that sustained military operation in Libya. We had 2011 in Syria. Remember the whole Red Line incident where there was a talk of military intervention. That was all resolved when the Russians put in their initiative to just come in and take out the chemical weapons. And now we're back at it again this year with another issue with Syria and Iraq. And now we have Congress voting some sort of authority, but we've also got the president saying, well, I don't really need that. I mean, I can do it whether they act or not. You know, what they're doing maybe is just sort of a hood ornament for this card, not something essential to it. So I'd say this the basic question is the co-determination rights of Congress about the war. And, you know, is Congress taking its rights and its authority seriously? I'm not so sure it is.
Yeah, well, there's an election coming up and they're afraid. And now one minor correction there. I'm sure you meant to say 2013, the chemical weapons red line thing, when you said 2011 there.
Just, exactly. 2011 was Libya. 2013 was Syria.
Right. Well, and they started the covert action in Syria then, but that, they had a finding, so that's perfectly illegal. Anyway, so back on the Libya thing for a second, because they started the war on a UN resolution that authorized a no-fly zone, but without any congressional authorization at all. And then you have the dynamic of a Democratic president and Republicans who are divided, some of them more hawkish, others of them, anti and following more of a Rand Paul line back then. And so what they did, though, was they had the vote in the House. They had a couple of different votes, and they failed to pass one to deauthorize the war and to try to make Obama end it. And then I forget whether they actually had the vote on the one to authorize it or if they pulled it at the last minute because they knew they didn't have the votes to pass the one to authorize. So in essence, either way, they failed to pass a thing to authorize. It's not just that they didn't pass it. There was one, and it did not get passed. And then they went on vacation, and then they came back and said, let's all talk about the debt ceiling and not the Libya war anymore. And that was the end of that discussion in the Congress. And so that's kind of a weird thing. I don't know if there's any precedent for that in history, where they had the opportunity to go either way, and they chose neither. And now the bumper music's playing. I'm sorry, but maybe we'll pick that up on the other side and some of the legalities of what Obama claimed about what counts as hostilities or not, and that kind of thing for the purposes of the War Powers Act. It's the great, brilliant genius, the other Scott Horton, author of the new book, Lords of Secrecy. We'll be right back. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Okay, finally, we're back. We're Scott Horton. Me, the host, and him, the interviewee, he's the other Scott Horton from Columbia University and Harper's Magazine. And we're talking about the war powers, Obama taking us back to war against the Islamic State. And yeah, point of clarification, just for sure, yeah, they're definitely not seeking a UN resolution there. Kerry's just up there talking, and eventually they're going to have something about, you know, some refugees or... you know, some minor issues, but they're not going through the UN on this, which I guess is fine because I never really understood, Scott, the legality of the UN charter anyway, because they submitted it to bare majorities to both houses of Congress, the UN Participation Act. So that's not really a treaty, which requires a supermajority in the U.S. Senate, according to the Constitution. But then again, of course, kind of like the point here, there is no Constitution. They do whatever they want. They call it whatever they want. And like in our current situation, the only solution to the Obama problem right now is impeachment. That's the only way to make a president stop doing what he's doing. And of course, the Congress doesn't want to do that any more than they want to authorize what he's doing. So they just go on and keep proving that really there is no law.
Well, there's a pernicious idea that gets thrown around there all the time that, you know, they don't, the government doesn't have to go to Congress and get approval through the American political process because the UN has approved it. The Security Council has passed a resolution, as if that's a substitute for the Constitution and the requirements of the Constitution. And they make all sorts of technical legal arguments to support that. But that's balderdash. It's nonsense.
And now Harry Truman did that in Korea, and I remember when I was a boy, that was how H.W. Bush started to treat the first Iraq war, right? Was Congress was an afterthought on this. You guys can authorize what we're doing anyway if you want to. Sure, climb on board. And but people got incensed about that and said,
That's right. I mean, this is an argument that gets trotted out by everybody, by people on the left, by people on the right. It's trotted out to support the president and the president's power grabs all the time. But, you know, legally, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
You know, the bottom line is that the president may have authority. The president's got to get his authority on both tracks. He's got to have his international law authority. He has to have his constitutional and domestic law authority in the United States. One is not a replacement for the other.
Mm-hmm. And now... well, I don't want to get too far off track, but so what was H.W.'s legal excuse for Panama? Because he didn't have any kind of resolution from anybody but his own National Security Council on that.
Yeah, well, that was response to a request from local authorities for assistance. It was a police action.
Oh, I see.
And that's an argument that the U.S. has used for military interventions in our hemisphere, you know, and the Dominican Republic and Grenada and places like that. We say it's a police action. Mm. But I think we should get back to the current problem, because I think we're seeing some arguments develop now which are really very, very dangerous, and they're flying right underneath the radar screen and not getting as much attention as they should. And the key one is that because of powerful new technologies the United States has, all of this democratic claptrap of congressional review and approval has become irrelevant. Because that we only have the argument goes, we only have to go to Congress and get congressional approval if they're boots on the ground, you know, because they're American soldiers, sailors, airmen who could possibly be at risk. So there's sort of an acceptance. Well, okay, Congress has some say about that. But hey, when it's our cruise missiles and our drones and our fighters up ahead, and there's no real risk of anybody being shot down or hurt because the people we're dealing with just don't have that sort of technology, hey, then Congress has nothing to say about it. That's been trotted out. In fact, that was even included in one of the Justice Department legal memoranda, the one from April 1st, 2011, that said the intervention in Libya without congressional approval was fine.
Yeah, they just changed the word to kinetic activities or something. And all of a sudden, that doesn't mean shooting explosives at people, which is a hostile act, right?
Yeah, nonsense. It's nonsense. It's basically saying, well, we have all this fancy new technology, and, you know, that's not what the authors of the Constitution were thinking about. Well, the authors of the Constitution were thinking about, you know, muskets and mortars and, you know, and men of war ships with hundreds of cannons. Yeah, that's true. They weren't thinking about the technologies we have today. But in terms of the principle that is embedded in the Constitution is that no sustained warfare overseas that does not have the approval of Congress. That's clearly in our Constitution. And part of the reason for it is Congress is supposed to be involved so there can be a good, thorough public discussion of these things. Not just that congressional leaders throw their support behind it, but that the public is brought in. The public has an opportunity to discuss these matters. And in the end of the day, if the country is going to war, it should be a united public. I mean, not that everybody has to have the same view, but basically the public should be on board. Congress should be on board. The executive should be on board. It shouldn't be a stealth war that's being handled by the president and his national security elites.
Right. And after all, if we're talking about a truly defensive war, you're going to have plenty of consensus from the people in the Congress to go ahead and do it anyway. The only times we got to debate this is when we're talking about starting aggressive wars against people who've never attacked us. How much debate should we have, and what level of legality and approval should we have for starting a war? Which is, you know, they said at the Nuremberg trials that that's the supreme war crime of all. That's the umbrella under which the rest of them take place. And as we've seen.
I think that's right. And if you look at American history, wars that result from America being attacked or that involved an attack on America were very broadly supported by the American people and by the Congress, and the nation was able to unite behind them. But offensive wars that never had a real strong basis, those are the ones that caused tremendous internal friction. The war with Mexico, for instance. The Spanish-American War also, which was launched with misrepresented events, remember the Maine. Mm-hmm. And the Vietnam War falls into that category as well. So, I think America has had all sorts of different experiences with wars overseas, but generally it's done much better when the country was united behind the idea of the war.
Right. Well, and we can see what you mean about the thoroughness of the debate and all of that with the way and the way the responsibility is weighted with the way they did it in 2003. I mean, compared to Obama, at least Bush went to Congress at all to get one of these so-called authorizations for him to decide later, which became, you know, the weasel word excuse for the Hillary Clintons of the world that it was Bush's decision, not theirs, even though they told him that he could decide. But the debate, like I mentioned, Henry Hyde, the head of the House Judiciary Committee, or I guess it was the Foreign Affairs Committee at the time, mocked Ron Paul for insisting on a declaration of war. And Ron Paul actually introduced one and voted against it in the committee. But he said, you know, I dare you guys to take responsibility, like in the law that you swore your oath to. If you want to declare this war, you declare it. It's on you. And what happened was, at the time, they just had these, you know, Joe Biden-style rubber stamp hearings about how great the war is going to be. Nothing like what would have happened if they had been bound truly by the law the way Ron Paul insisted that they should have been and had to take the responsibility themselves to start the war. They might have asked what's going to happen and who is this Muqtada al-Sadr guy anyway and these kinds of things before they launched the war.
I think this is the key point to make here is that with Bush 1 and 2, you had a lot of people in their senior national security team who believed fervently, you know, Cheney and Rumsfeld right at the top of the group, that the president just had the right to go do this. He didn't have to go to Congress. He didn't have to get any approval. He didn't have to present it in a speech to the American people or anything of that sort. But both Bush Sr. and Bush Jr., notwithstanding that advice from their senior advisors, went to Congress and got the congressional approval, and that occurred after a full debate and discussion, or let's say at least some extended debate and discussion. And if we fast forward to what's been going on in Washington now, the last 4, 5, 6 years, we just don't see that happening anymore. I mean, now, Obama and his team, who criticized those people who said the president can do this unilaterally. I mean, Obama gave an interview to Charlie Savage at the Boston Globe in which he said, no, the president has to have congressional approval before launching a military attack on Iran. That was the question he got. But now you look at Obama as president, and he's embracing and acting on ideas that are much like those of Cheney and Rumsfeld, and not doing the right thing, a la the two Bushes, and going to Congress anyway. Although, you know, he did in 2012 and again this year say, well, Congress should have a discussion. But he said that as if it would be helpful to have it, not that he needed it.
Right. Well, and interestingly, he went to Congress in 2013 over Syria when he wanted them to save him from his stupid red line remark and get him out of the woods on having to go to war against Syria. He said, you guys voted down for me. They ended up not even having the vote at all.
Exactly right.
And thank goodness Putin intervened and gave him an out. But anyway, I'm sorry we're out of time. But thank you so much for coming back on the show, Scott. I sure appreciate it.
Hey, great to be with you.
That's the other Scott Horton, everybody. See you next week.